Hello, everybody. This video is going to be a response. I know I've waited a long time to post, but I just honestly haven't had the time to make this response. But this is going to be a response to Fido Bogan's video, which I think is an excellent video titled Becoming Ambient, where he makes his arguments for why he doesn't talk about hypergamy. And amongst other things, like why the men's movement should essentially become ambient, meaning having, I guess, no real focus, so a million different points of emission or contact or whatever, which I agree with in terms of becoming ambient. But I do have some disagreements and clarifications that I'd like to make, and so I'll take the opportunity to post those here. I did post them on my blog, and I suggest you watch this video first, Fido Bogan's video, before you watch this one, just for some context, because I will be quoting him in this video, in order to respond to his statements. So you should get the full context of the full video first before watching this. So I guess I'll just get straight to it. Now, the following quote is from Fido Bogan. In regards to why he doesn't talk about hypergamy. And so I'll just read off the following quote. Quote, "Now I too wish to filter and forestall human behaviors, which needless to say includes the female kind. However, my take on hypergamy, Breifeld's law, and all the rest of that is purely agnostic. I declare no opinion on these matters because I do not claim to know. That is agnosticism for you. So when it comes to filtering out harmful female behaviors, I use a simpler method. Simply stated, I hold women morally accountable, and if they don't measure up, I filter them out. So any harmful behavior that might arise from the dark workings of primitive programming would be cut off at the pass by my system of ethical standards and security clearances. There is a word for this sort of thing, civilization. I should add that this would work for anybody, even if they do believe in hypergamy, etc. Just calibrate your tests and standards according to your theoretical model without talking about your theoretical model," end quote. My question to Fido Bogan is why the agnosticism? I mean, why the claim of not claiming to know when my assessment of these things can in fact be known if one is willing simply to address it fairly? What me and Stardust have created, in essence, and I'll use the word created loosely since our theories borrow heavily from past assessments, people like Schopenhauer, etc. But all me and Stardust have created on our channels respectively is, as Fido Bogan has called it, a predictive model for general female behavior. That's it. Nothing more. Our theories do not and have never been claimed to predict individual female behavior because it's simply not possible to do so. And in fact, I can only speak for myself. I don't know how Stardust approaches women, but as for myself, I find that most people, myself included, have this same filtering behavior, albeit with a bit of suspicion towards women in our daily lives, because, well, we know what women can do in terms of things like false rape accusations and the like. But in general, I treat people as individuals in my daily life when I come across them, no matter what their gender. In general, there are many exceptions where I think it's appropriate to treat women differently and men differently, but that's neither here nor there. All one has to do to know the validity of these theories is simply to test them. Now, when we speak of hypergamy and Breifeld's law, etc., we're in fact discussing all the manifestations of bigger, better deal, provision at all cost behavior exhibited by women in general. But in the general sense, all our theories claim to do is predict general female behavior. It's literally the same thing. It's something. It's as innocuous and non-misogynistic as pointing out female demographics or the demographics of any other group, whether it be cultural, racial, whatever. There is instinctual hypergamy and there is politicized hypergamy, which we see as feminism. And this can be demonstrated by women voting in the majority for the party who provides to them the most benefits and entitlements. In this case, very obviously the Democratic Party. Now, I claim that women will express their politicized hypergamy even if it's playing a major part in their nation's bankruptcy. And to test this, we simply look at the fact that women have been voting Democrat in the majority for decades now. And so why can we accurately predict the way women will vote in the majority? Because we can infer from the nature of women, their voting patterns, their financial decisions, their marriage fidelity, and a great many more things that will follow general trends, which is once again, all the theories I posit claim to do. Now, the purpose of agnosticism is to acknowledge the possibility of the existence of something that is untestable, something that we may suspect, but is too enigmatic for us to understand and grasp. And there is nothing, I repeat, nothing enigmatic about female nature. I'm sure many advertising companies construct their entire business models around the exploitation of it. You know, look at people like Edward Bernays, you know, and look up the article about his freedom torches. Many of you will know exactly what I'm talking about when I say freedom torches. Women can be deconstructed down to a science. Their general behaviors can be deconstructed down to a science. You know, Barack Obama exploits female nature. Joe Biden exploits it. And in fact, I'm sure a large amount of their campaign was dedicated completely to understanding and exploiting female nature. It's how they got their votes. You know, even women exploit female nature. Oprah is one of the richest people in the world because she exploited it. Advertising agencies and politicians exploit female nature to extract wealth from men. So it's only fair that men going their own way exploit and understand female nature to keep from having their wealth and happiness taken from them. So in short, you know, I talk about hypergamy and Breifoldt's law because historically it seems that everyone but the average everyday man is clued into female nature and is using it to their advantage. And in a time where women default to their most base biological imperatives after expertly exploiting male nature to justify what can only be described as legal theft of male wealth, divorce being one of a myriad of examples of this, there is nothing, and I mean absolutely nothing, wrong with a bit of reciprocation on the part of men. Now keep in mind that our goal, the goal of men going their own way, at least this variant of it, is merely to conserve our wealth and our economic power and freedoms, whereas the so-called fairer sex's goal is unfortunately all too often to deprive men of theirs, which is why I follow a basic rule when deciding the importance of what I should or shouldn't say in my videos. I ask myself simply that if I had a son, would I want him to know about a particular topic, no matter how un-PC or offensive it may be to women? Now, if the answer is yes, then I have absolutely no problem talking about it in a video of mine, because if it's important enough to warn a son about, it's important enough to warn men and boys about. And I don't care if that doesn't jive well with MRA goals or feminism's goals or anybody else's goals, because my son now knows what he needs to know in order to survive the current misandric culture that we've been inundated with. And if these things have to be said in a way that sounds sexist against women, then so be it. I'm perfectly fine with that. Because, you see, I'm not anti-women, but I'm certainly pro-male. And I'm not going to hide anything from men in order to make women feel better about themselves. Consider me female neutral, meaning that I don't seek to do damage to women, but I do seek to give men and boys as much of an advantage as possible, so long as I don't deprive women of their basic fundamental human rights. I am pro-male, meaning that I am not worried about what women are doing. I'm worried about what men are doing, and I'm worried about the well-being of boys and men, because from where I'm standing, women have a hell of a lot more help than men and boys. So I'm not one of these people in the men's movement that talks incessantly about how, you know, we have to be fair to both men and women. We've been being fair to women for a very long time now. And nobody's being unfair to women. And everybody's being unfair to men and boys. Women have more than fairness. In fact, they have privilege. This variant of men going their own way is designed to instill both cultural and economic sovereignty in men and boys. In short, we are not concerned with the nature of women for any other reason than the fact that male ignorance of it leads to male suffering, misery, and disenfranchisement. We have no interest in faulting women for hypergamy. We have no interest in coaxing women towards repressing it like our traditionalist predecessors. What we want is for men to understand when and how it expresses itself, because it is dangerous for them not to. Now, this context allows feminism to be viewed as an expression of female biological motives, and the rest is simply an exposition of how the state is capitalizing on this. Now, we don't see feminism as being some great novel evil that corrupted womankind. And if you do view it this way, you're taking an incredibly simple-minded approach to the problems that men and boys face in society. As I've said in many previous videos, and I've given numerous citations and evidences to back it up, feminism was an organic process. You know, I like to compare it when we send satellites to orbit or even land on Mars. This is, you know, the current one is what, the Curiosity rover or what have you. Now, when these engineers design these satellites that are destined for the red planet, they understand that physics explains to us that when there's no force acting on an object that's already at a constant velocity, it's just going to keep on traveling at that velocity until an external force acts on it. So when we get one of these Mars landers up into orbit and you know, we jettison it off of its payload or whatever got it out of Earth's atmosphere, whatever fuel supply, rocket or whatever got it out of Earth's atmosphere, then you see the little disengagement, you see the disengagement and those I guess what you would call booster rockets setting it off on its I don't know, 6, 7, 8 month trajectory. I don't know how long it takes to get to Mars, but the physicists and the engineers that designed this Mars lander knows that when it reaches that jettison speed, there's nothing that's going to stop it, because there's no gravity to decrease its velocity. There's no other forces decreasing its velocity from the point of where it jettisoned off its rocket outside of Earth's atmosphere to the point where it gets to Mars's atmosphere, where it will then be slowed down upon re-entry into Mars's, or entry into Mars's orbit. Meaning that these engineers only had to plan specific details in the very beginning. They had to tinker around with the construction of this Mars lander and things like that, but in the end they knew that for the most part the trip was going to be made based off simple inertia and constant velocity and the rules of mechanical motion. There was nothing that they had to do in order to get this satellite from point A to point B. The laws of physics were going to take care of that all on their own. And in terms of feminism, if there was any kind of engineering done in you know, a social engineering done in the creation of feminism, it was something that was done in a way that would capitalize off of the nature of men and women, and all the legwork would be done by the fact that this was custom made to capitalize off the natures of women and men, and particularly women would be extremely would take an extreme liking to feminism. They knew that this was going to happen if it was engineered in the first place. This is something we can't even prove. So again, we don't see feminism as being some great novel evil that corrupted womankind. We see it as being an eventuality of technological advancement and inefficient traditional familial norms that projected what are generally male qualities like familial fidelity and loyalty and all that onto women who were only there for children and protection and provision in the first place, which resulted in feminism. You know, if there was any kind of pre-feminist tinkering, social engineering and the like, it was minimal, and it can't even be proven. So there's no point in talking about who made feminism and how it's this great, you know, evil that has to be extinguished and then everything's going to go back to normal. Things have radically changed. They never will go back to quote-unquote normal. They're not coming back. Those days are gone. You might as well accept it and join us instead of bitching and whining about feminism incessantly. It's getting old. You know, I'm tired of talking about feminism and like it's this it's, you know, it's just getting conspiratorial. The fact is, there's nothing random about feminism. It behaves the way it does, not because of feminists or Marxism or leftists, but because women and men behave the way they do and certain taboos are no longer in play. Since women have categorically refused to not indulge their base biological drives for the benefit of men, I've drawn the conclusion that men should take control of their base biological drives for their own interests. Since male biological imperatives are so interrelated and intertwined with those of women, we must learn to discern when and how these imperatives interact precisely so that men have the capability to protect themselves. This isn't about bashing women. This is about protecting men. This is a weapon that we're going to arm ourselves with in light of the attacks that have been leveled against us for the better part of half a century. We're done being beat up. We want to fight back. Hence the need for a comprehensive understanding of hypergamy and all the other associated male or female drives that can be harmful to or exploited against men. We wish the MRA as much success in their goal of reforming marriage laws, but if they fail, men going their own way will have not gotten married in the first place. And why? Well, because we understand that marriage in a historical sense was in many respects nothing more than a repression of female hypergamy. We've seen what happened when these restraints are lifted, and as such, for our own male interests, we will never participate in the institution of marriage again. So essentially, we are not MRAs and are positing different solutions to similar problems. Now, there need not be any conflict over this, simply an understanding that our approaches are different. So when, for example, Fido Bogan says something, and I'm going to quote from his video again, when he says something like, quote, now, there are considered politic reasons why a person might choose not to speak publicly about hypergamy and such. For starters, you're making it easy for people to call you a misogynist or whatnot. And do I personally give a snap if somebody calls me that? No, not personally. I've been called a misogynist plenty of times for no clear reason, and I've got a mighty thick skin for it. But look, here's my game. I make it hard for them. I make them work for it. For the plain truth is that I never make anti-women statements. I attack feminism savagely, ferociously. I call it a social cancer and all manner of bloody awful things, but I never say bad things about women. End quote. Particularly what stuck out to me about that statement is that he says that we never say anything bad about women. Well, we're not saying anything bad about women when it's the truth. Women are doing these things. So if to say these things is to say bad things about women, to say that they're divorcing, that they're taking that they have this incredible affinity for feminism, that they're taking men to divorce court on a daily basis and ruining men's lives, and that no women's groups are out there, you know, protesting this kind of thing. No women's groups are out there talking about how false rape accusations destroy the lives of men. You know, and the only women that are doing this are women that have, essentially joined the men's movement, which is a men's creation. You know, no women have taken it upon themselves to independently, outside of the influence of men, form their own groups and admonish and reject and rebuke these actions that women are taking. No women are sticking up and defending men all on their own by themselves without men being there first, doing it first. Why is it bad to say these things? If it's bad to say these things about women, then it's bad to say the truth about women. And when he says that, and when, you know, Fido Bogan says things like this, we men going their own way really see it as a way of saying something to the effect of, you know, well, I don't personally care that they call me a misogynist, but I'm going to play their game anyway and give them power and expend precious time and energy on making myself sound non-misogynist, which they'll end up calling Fido Bogan one anyway, by the way. So what I do when I hear that is simply say to myself, you know, they, feminists, they derive their power precisely by the fear others have of being called a misogynist. So I'm going to say whatever I please and just let the cards fall where they may. Now, I think one of the biggest mistakes that we make is to assume that if we just make our case logically enough and if we just take extra care to phrase things in a way that cannot be said to be misogynist, that feminists won't still successfully portray us as such. They don't care. They care nothing about your not giving them the opportunity to call you a misogynist. They actually know you're not one. The people we're up against are the actual misogynists. I mean, they go along with affirmative action for women, for example. Because why? Well, because although they'll never admit it, they believe deep down that women are inferiors. They are the bigots. They're the bigots, and they know it. They don't fluster because you show them through measured rhetoric that you aren't one. Bigots recognize bigots just fine. We don't have to show them that we aren't. Feminist power to exist as bigots is derived from their ability or rather their social authority to define what a bigot is. And they define it in a way that their bigotry is always beyond scrutiny. And that's why they nestle their bigotry deep into the programmed rhetoric of violence against women and domestic violence and rape. Because once a Fido Bogan even broaches the topic of violence against women in any way that doesn't acknowledge feminism's victim narrative, it will put women on the defensive. And furthermore, once they hear you talking about how domestic violence is usually reciprocal and that women are just as violent, if not more violent than men are, you can successfully be branded as misogynist. That's all it takes. It doesn't matter how non-misogynistic you phrased it, they've got you squarely pegged as misogynist. Feminists have you squarely pegged as misogynist just by you saying that. Feminists know that if they can cordon debate around the primal fears of women, no amount of male logic will win him the debate. Feminists are extremely good at this. Women are extremely susceptible to it. Hence my belief that it is a waste of time trying to convince the masses of women on this subject. In the general sense, the only ones that can objectively understand it in large numbers outside of their hind brains are men. These people, feminists, know that they're the misogynists, and they also know that the more you point it out, the more society will perceive you as a misogynist. And unfortunately, too many women are willing to blindly defend this lie, because they know that the benefits made available to them by feminism are intimately related to this authority given to feminists to obfuscate their bigotry by defining anyone who points out their bigotry as being the bigot themselves. Victimhood, you see, is power in a society, as we all know, and victimhood status must be maintained at all costs, and the feminists know this. And women know this almost on an instinctual level. The feminists and the large blocks of women that support them, and even the men that support them, aren't going to let a trivial thing like Fiedelbogen or Barbarossa's tactfully phrased non-misogynistic refutation of feminism get in the way of that power. Feminism is a power grab, you know, female empowerment. Most women don't even identify as feminists, but if you start attacking the privileges that feminism gives them, in a way that suggests an unspoken understanding that feminism is a well-organized female privilege and advocacy group. Feminists provide women with female privilege, oftentimes directly at the expense of men. Women provide feminism with the majority of their political capital and votes. It's a symbiotic relationship that we caught a glimpse of when, for example, Republicans targeted VAWA and the whole Sandra Fluke birth control fiasco kicked off. Now, what did feminist politicians call that? Well, they called it a war on women. Not a war on feminists, but a war on women. What does that tell you? Where were the women that lecture MRAs on how bad it is to generalize women then, when feminists decided to call an attack on laws passed by feminists an attack on women themselves? I guess women didn't quite have too much of a problem with that generalization and that conflation of women and feminists, did they? So when we hear the oft-quoted men's rights meme of feminism is an ideology, women are a gender, and we shouldn't conflate the two. Well, this is correct. You know, it's absolutely correct. And yet, somehow, this phrase conveniently overlooks that this also holds true for the millions of women divorcing their husbands. Are we to believe that it is millions of feminists who see men as either inherent oppressors or rapists deciding to marry and then start families with and subsequently divorce and extort millions of men? Women who supposedly hate men, feminists? No, I mean, these women that are doing this aren't feminists, and neither are most of the women filing false domestic violence and rape accusations. They are everyday, average women taking advantage of the privileges given to them by feminism in order to destroy men. This is a hell of a lot more complex and a hell of a lot more insidious than simply saying that feminism is bad and women are good. It's so much more complicated than that. It's so much more interrelated than that. Let's try not having such a simplistic view of the world. You know, men are in this too, and I don't deny that, and I've never denied that. And I come out, you know, viciously attacking white knights and male feminists and so on and so forth. It's not that simple. It is not that simple. Women and feminism are very interrelated. Very, very interrelated. So the question I want to ask to men everywhere, and particularly men concerned exclusively with gaining legal equality between men and women, or in other words, MRAs, is what evidence do we have to suggest that women even want equality? Because I can show you plenty of evidence to suggest that they don't. And as it stands, feminists offer women privilege, protection, and provision, while all we have to offer is equality with all of its implied loss of privilege. What incentive do women have to choose equality over privilege? That's all we're offering at this point. Remember that. Again, I don't classify feminism as a female supremacism movement. I'm going to say that again. I don't classify feminism as a female supremacism movement. I classify it as a female advocacy at all cost movement, although supremacism most certainly exists within its ranks. But female advocacy is what feminism really is about. Behind the veneer of male hatred and misogyny, there is an interconnectedness between women and feminism, where the female advocacy for the female vote trade-off functions as feminism's blood-brain barrier. This is why unmarried women in particular backed President Obama in the election by a 38% margin. Those type of election demographics don't happen by accident. There must exist huge incentive for record-breaking numbers of women to vote for what is the most feminist president in history in such large numbers. I mean, were the millions of women that voted for President Obama all radical feminists, or even feminists at all? No, most were everyday women that simply understood the bottom line, which is, if she gives feminists her support politically, they keep her privileges intact. As Stardust refers to them, we can call these women lowercase f feminists. So saying for the purposes of clarification that feminism is political ideology and women are a gender doesn't really clarify anything for men. Instead, we ought to propose saying that feminism is a massive political female advocacy group that women support in the majority as an actual statement that will help men understand feminism the way it actually exists in the real world. Now, at the very least, this is a statement that I would give to any man who has simply given up working within the system and with women, whom I view and many men view as a competing social, political, economic class that will look out for their own interests, regardless of whatever fantasies men have ginned up thinking about what their relation to women is. You know, you can believe in that little fairy tale about men having this special ethereal bond with women, but women are still taking your jobs. They're still taking your spots in education via affirmative action. They're still making more money than you on average. They're still staying employed longer than you on average. They're still receiving more government funding for health benefits than you are as a man. They're still doing all of this, okay? That's not going to change because you have this special little, you know, leave it to beaver mentality. The reality is that women are competing with men. They are a competing special interest group. They are out for themselves. And I don't blame them for it because women should have every right to pursue, you know, their own interests so long as they don't infringe upon the rights of men. Let me make it clear. I don't want to tell women what to do in any way, so long as they are not interfering with the fundamental human rights of men. From this point on, this channel is dedicated to telling men how to manage their expectations of women and society in general to avoid being put through the meat grinder. But we are not trying to control women. Leave that to the traditionalists and the, you know, family-friendly MRA types. I'm not saying all MRAs are like that, but the certain contingent of MRAs that are on this kind of, oh, the whole point of the men's movement is to repair relations between men and women type thing. They all know who they are. There are many MRAs who are just to clarify, because I don't want to stir up trouble here. There are many MRAs who are simply just strictly concerned with the rights of men. And I wish those MRAs luck. I wish them success. But again, well-wishing kind of naive ideas about how men and women interact that kind of reject things like evolutionary psychology and Breivik's law and all of these things that have been time-tested throughout decades of feminist sexual liberation. They are not going to work in reality, and reality is going to continue unabated regardless of your little fantasies about men and women. So again, you know, it all boils down to differing approaches to similar problems between MRAs and men going their own way. This is the exact reason why I don't call myself an MRA anymore. You're not going to get MRA rhetoric here. I simply do not approach our mutually acknowledged problems in the same manner, and I'm quite happy to explain to others that my words and arguments should not be taken as MRA rhetoric. With all that said, we're going to now address Fido Bogan's commentary in regards to the SPLC. He said, quote, "And yes, I am famous for getting onto the SPLC hate list, but the people who posted that list are a tiny clique of intellectual cowards. They are not the general public, for the general public would never throw a second glance at somebody like me. Furthermore, the general public has no idea what the SPLC is up to, and the SPLC knows this, which is why it has the gumption to do what it does," end quote. This assertion is incorrect for the same reason that most people have no idea who pens the annual list of new or current groups likely to espouse or engage in terrorism. Now, I couldn't possibly tell you which terrorist group watch group said it, but I know that there's a big push to label the new terrorist threat as being, you know, homegrown or patriots or lone wolves or people who read the Constitution just a little bit too much And the vast majority of people don't know who said this either, and yet the media is repeating it. And this meme will surely be used to ram some constitution-scrapping post-Patriot Act monstrosity through Congress eventually. Eventually it'll happen. And the meme self-perpetuates, and the consequences don't care who said it. This is how things operate in this culture. This is how new ideas are instilled into the public consciousness without their consent. People have figured out a way, the media in general has figured out a way to frame political and public discourse expertly. And so if the SPLC labels us as a hate group, that is a very troubling development, I think. Because you see, feminism, like all of the other isms, usually, you know, harmful isms, usually operates on mimetics. You know, its method of propagation is the constant repetition of lies, a constant mimicry of an authority figure's talking points. You know, so-and-so said one in five women are, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It's a reflection of our society's abdication of critical thought to the expert class. Now, the reason that it doesn't matter that many people don't know what the SPLC is because it makes no difference in terms of the danger that their classification of men's groups as hate groups poses. It's the same reason why so many lies and so much pseudoscientific drivel is often prefaced by the words experts say, or scientists have found, or the authorities have discovered, etc. In this society, for all intents and purposes, we have now been conflated by the SPLC with white supremacists, or the new Black Panther Party, or the Westboro Baptist Church, and so on. And when the men's movement actually starts to receive television interviews on CNN or other mainstream media outlets, believe me, the general public will be reminded of it by the media. It'll be a hit piece. You'll see. You'll see what I'm talking about when it happens. The fact is that if the SPLC had no use for classifying the men's movement as a hate group, they wouldn't have bothered to do it in the first place. It doesn't matter that we're not a hate group at all. Because you see, in Oceania, all that matters is that it was said by an authority figure that we are. And the rest is taken care of by female solipsism and herd thinking. Now, remember what Winston said about women in George Orwell's 1984. He said, quote, "He disliked nearly all women, and especially the young and pretty ones, who were the most bigoted adherents of the party, the swallowers of slogans, the amateur spies, and the nosers out of unorthodoxy," end quote. Now, this amazing little quote encapsulates our situation perfectly and is the reason why the particular feminists in the Warren Farrell debacle equated MRAs with being, quote, pro-incest and pro-rape. I mean, she knows that women will parrot this. It doesn't matter that it's not true. It matters that she heard it somewhere. Now, can you find misogyny in George Orwell's statement? If you're looking for it, absolutely. And if you look deeper, you notice that there isn't a disgust here for any inherent femaleness, but towards the oppressive behaviors they exhibit and the destructive memes they perpetuate. And that, my MRA friends, is a source of feminism's power, whether it sounds misogynist or not. And lastly, Fido Bogan wrote this. He said, quote, "As a parting thought, I note with interest that Barbarossa declines to call himself a non-feminist. Well, since I am pretty sure that he would also decline to call himself a feminist, what does that leave? Yes, Barbarossa, it looks like you are a non-feminist whether you like it or not, unless you prefer to be a feminist. Well, no, I didn't think so. But fear not, non-feminism is a wide-open frontier territory with room to spare for any non-feminist man or woman who wants to carve out a homestead. We are all non-feminists after all, or do we prefer to be feminist? Well, no, I didn't think so," end quote. Now, I understand, you know, the point that you're trying to make here, Fido Bogan, but let me try to clarify it with a simple metaphor. Now, Fido Bogan has referred to feminism as a cancer, but I perceive it a bit differently, albeit similarly. Now, I perceive feminism as a malignant tumor. Cancer is caused by genetic predispositions, in this case, things like male and female nature. It's caused by environmental factors, you know, in this case, the changing roles of men and women that technology has facilitated. And it's caused by usually a host of other, you know, usually unseen factors, like, for example, government figuring out that they could guarantee female votes by exploiting female hypergamy. Tumors, on the other hand, are symptoms of the cancer. You know, we do not treat this tumor cell by malignant cell. We deal in collections of cells. We deal in cell masses and growths. When a tumor is found, we radiate it. We target it with chemotherapy. We know some healthy cells are going to be affected by this radiation, just like some women will be unfairly generalized. But the tumor must go, and the generalizations must be made, because the tumor, feminism, has the potential to be a hell of a lot more dangerous than a couple of misplaced generalizations. That is my simple metaphor for feminism, and that is why I can accurately say that I am not a non-feminist or an anti-feminist. I simply exist outside of the binary of non or pro-feminism or pro and anti-feminism or whatever other binary you want to exist in. Because saying that I'm not or even anti-feminist is like saying I'm non or even anti-tumor. One cannot be anti-tumor, but one can be pro-cancer prevention. So before our poor guy ends up on a chemo radiation cocktail, I wish to sit him down and tell him, look, you have a predisposition to lung cancer, and cigarettes cause lung cancer, and lung cancer causes malignant tumors, so don't smoke cigarettes. Similarly, I sit men down and tell them, you have a predisposition to want to please women. Things like hypergamy are explained to him in the same way that one would explain the dangers of cigarettes to someone with a predisposition to lung cancer. I'll explain to him that cigarettes have always been carcinogenic, but recent developments in technology coupled with zero regulations on what cigarette manufacturers can put into cigarettes have resulted in a cigarette with dozens of more carcinogens than the first cigarettes ever had. The equivalent of telling men that women have always been hypergamous, but our current level of technological advancement and the loosening of checks on hypergamy, along with the collapse of traditionalism, has brought about women which exhibit advanced hypergamy, such that it has now become politicized, and this is what we collectively see and identify as feminism. Now, there's one more, I guess, men's rights meme that I want to address, and this has nothing to do with Fido Bogan. From here on out, Fido Bogan has nothing to do with what I'm saying here. I don't want any confusion about that. But there's this meme in the manosphere that I've seen, not only in men's rights blog, but in the general manosphere as a whole, whenever the topic of hypergamy comes up, essentially extending to them what I've called in the past the evolutionary pussy pass. This concept that women, you know, can't control hypergamy, and as such, it's not their fault. It's not a fault on their part. It's not a moral failing on their part. This is only partly correct. It's a malformed statement that does nothing to elucidate the situation as it stands in reality. Now, if female hypergamy and all the things that come with it, and all of the extras, the extra things that are similar to it that women exhibit in their behavior, If female hypergamy absolves women of the things they do, then we should shut up about feminism altogether, because feminism, as I've described earlier, feeds off of female nature. It sustains itself off of it. Feminism couldn't exist without it, as I've discussed previously. Now, there's the issue here to be discussed of criminal negligence. Men and women both have animal instincts and biological imperatives that, in the right context, are destructive when overindulged. But it seems that women have become so hopelessly beholden to their natural instincts that they have greatly advanced the destructive power of feminism in doing so, and have made no efforts to keep their base instincts in check. I mean, they're like alcoholics, specifically with generations of alcoholics in their ancestry and families. That is to say, a genetic predisposition to alcoholism. You know, they may not be able to help drinking, but they damn sure better make sure they keep themselves sober when they drive, because that's what society expects of them. Because surrendering to your desire for alcohol so much that you can't go without it even while driving is a disaster waiting to happen. And they are not allowed that kind of criminal negligence. We are not going to allow your categorical inability to suppress your biological compulsions make society at large unsafe for the rest of us to be in. Let's give an example of this. Men are hardwired to like youth and females. And whatever you think about the whole, age of consent, I know a lot of people put forth the idea that feminists have sought historically to raise the age of consent to kind of bypass certain facts about biology in terms of women or girls. I'm sorry, I don't know what you would even call them. You see, this is the conditioning coming out of my very words here. Girls, women, whatever you call them, but girls that are physically mature, for example, at 16 years old, have historically been married to men, adult men in their 20s or 30s or what have you, throughout history. This has happened throughout history. And so many of us put forth that the idea that feminists have tried to consistently get the age of consent barrier raised in order to try to limit the biological realities that men and women share in terms of courtship and when it becomes age appropriate. But whatever it is you think about that idea, put it aside for a second and understand that men are hardwired biologically to like youth in females, to look for youth and seek out youth in females for the purposes of reproduction. And yet our society has deemed it unacceptable for a 40-year-old man to be with a 15-year-old girl to the point of illegality. Now, if that 40-year-old man has consensual sex with that 15-year-old physically mature girl, he's going to jail. And the judge isn't going to care that men are biologically hardwired to want youth in the opposite sex. The truth is that if human beings hadn't demanded that we sometimes act in opposition to our base biological drives, we would have never successfully developed civilization in the first place. And so female instinct and its particular taste for the security and safety of the female is no excuse for the way they've demonstrated such an affinity for feminism, even while they see it destroying men, even while they use it to destroy men. There's a level of complicity in women with feminism that anyone objectively observing it and that's willing to just say what it is cannot ignore. The question, I think, is what should the consequences be? Well, I'm not so naive as to think that the entire female gender bears any total responsibility for feminism. I've never said that, never will. I do not make such an indictment. But I do believe that it is time for a fundamental shift in how men view women. Now, some have inaccurately referred to this suggestion as me claiming that women have a fundamentally mercenary nature or a insurmountably flawed nature. But I suggest you hear what I call it from my mouth instead of taking the word of others in regards to what I have said. I do not claim that we view women as having mercenary or flawed nature, but as simply having an incompatible nature for the traditionalist setup that existed before feminism. And this is what is categorically important for men to understand and retain for whatever it is we put in place after feminism. It isn't about hating women, but dispelling our current understanding of them. To put it as simply as possible, we don't hate women, but we do understand them. And we want as many men as possible to understand them as well. And understand that men have been lied to about the way women see them and the way women are. We've been told essentially that lead cups are optimal for drinking out of. And the fact that we know that believing this about lead will result in us poisoning ourselves doesn't mean that we hate lead. We just know that while lead is used for many things, it sure is a terrible tool for making cups to drink out of. So no more lies about marriage and love and romance. Men and women are not lovers. We fuck, we make babies, and we set up all sorts of customs and traditions around that. And oftentimes the traditions become so thoroughly ensconced for so long that we forget why they're even there. And when we forget why they're there in the first place, we can no longer judge whether or not they're still useful at any given point in time. And that is what happened with traditionalism. We created the lies of romantic love and chivalry and traditionalism because men needed to believe in women being with him because they loved them instead of because they needed them. And when women figured out that they no longer needed men, that they could work for themselves or rely on government to extract wealth from men, that little fantasy was shattered into a billion pieces. I like to call it the feminist DMT trip. Never taken any psychedelics, but any of you that have probably know what I'm talking about. DMT, dimethyltryptamine, is a chemical that takes you on a rapid trip, the onset of which occurs literally seconds after the consumption of the drug, and it takes you to what has been described as a completely different reality. And that's what the collapse of traditionalism did. It rushed us. It catapulted men, rather unwillingly, to a position exactly one half of the distance to true reality, a true view of women and how they see us. Now, the rest is up to us. The rest is up to us and whether or not we want to really see it. So the next decade or two will be quite interesting to see how things really unfold. We'll see what happens. That's all I gotta say for now. Thank you for listening.